From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Frank Oz brought to life Miss Piggy, Cookie Monster, and other Muppet celebrities. Now he's directing human stars like Steve Martin and Michael Caine. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the director of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Muppets Take Manhattan, and Little Shop of Horrors. Also today, we talk with Mickey Hart, drummer with the Grateful Dead. On his travels with the dead, he's recorded musicians and singers from around the world. Those tapes have been released on CD in a new world music series. Rock historian Ed Ward plays some women rockers who tried to capitalize on the success of Elvis Presley. And we have a new poem from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. All 54 people aboard a Brazilian airliner missing since yesterday were found alive today in the Amazon rainforest. The Varig Airlines Boeing 737-200 disappeared from radar screens last night after the pilot radioed he was going to attempt an emergency landing because the airliner had lost its directional system. Airline officials say several rescue planes received SOS radio signals while searching for the plane. President Bush is back in Washington after a three-week-long vacation at his seaside retreat in Kennebunkport, Maine. He returns to a full agenda that goes into full swing tomorrow, as Michael Richards reports.
At the top of the president's agenda is the new federal drug policy. He's scheduled to unveil it tomorrow at his first nationally televised address to the nation. The Bush administration's war on drugs is expected to cost nearly $8 billion. Well, there probably won't be a lot of debate over money for fighting drug abuse. The president will probably face some tough fights over other spending priorities as the summer gives way to the fall. There's a good deal of opposition on Capitol Hill to his defense spending plan. He's also proposing a cut in the capital gains tax, the money people make from investing in stocks and other property. Many Democrats are adamantly opposed. There have also been some indications that the administration plans a move this week to get emergency food aid to Poland. Overall, there ought to be a lot of back and forth between the White House and Capitol Hill on all aspects of the federal budget in the coming days as the government's fiscal year comes to a close at the end of the month. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
A lone gunman opened fire on passengers today at the international airport in Medellin, Colombia. One man was killed, 12 were injured before police shot the gunman. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Police in Medellin say the gunman was carrying no identity papers, and they do not know whether he was connected to the Medellin cocaine cartel. The attack was apparently random, and police say it may be unrelated to the violence that has swept this country since a crackdown on drug traffickers began here 2.5 weeks ago. Another apparent terrorist act in Medellin was narrowly averted today. Police there report they found a bomb on an Avianca commercial airliner that had just arrived from Cali, where Colombia's second cocaine cartel is located. The police say they located the bomb after an anonymous caller tipped them off. In Bogota, I'm Tom Gelton.
An NAACP official today accused authorities of overreacting during two nights of clashes between black college students and police in the resort community of Virginia Beach. Up to 23 people were injured. More than 100 stores were looted in confrontations which disrupted the Labor Day holiday. Police say up to 100,000 young people attending an annual fraternity festival were on the streets when rioting broke out early yesterday. Violence resumed last night. This is NPR News. The West German government decided today to house an expected wave of German refugees in public buildings because heavy rains have made specially built campsites unfit for use. The Red Cross, which has worked hard to erect tents for around 4,500 people in just a few days, said it did not know if the government plans to scrap the camps altogether. A strike called in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan met with mixed results today. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports the local People's Front called for the action to push their demand for greater autonomy.
It's been hard to gauge how widespread the response has been to this strike. According to the Popular Front, its call for action was observed by almost all the factories inside Baku and many elsewhere in the Republic, as well as workers at the port and freight railways. But according to a spokesman for the Azerbaijani official news agency, after a slow start, many of the capital's enterprises, including the port, had been working, and independent observers confirmed that the response to the strike had been mixed. It would seem seemed that though the Azerbaijani Popular Front can pull a crowd of 100,000 to its weekend rallies, its list of demands, including its own legalization, new elections, and an end to Moscow's rule of Nagorno-Karabakh, is perhaps too broad to galvanize support for a general strike.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall in Moscow. Soviet space officials made preparations today for the launch of two cosmonauts on a 6-month mission to reopen their Mir space station. The station was left unmanned by the Soviets in a cost-cutting move that gave space planners time to design new equipment. The two cosmonauts will try out a new Soviet space bicycle to carry out work outside the orbiting complex and fit the space station with a docking port for the Buran space shuttle. A radical Fatah Palestinian group said today it executed 15 people on charges of spying for the West. A spokesman for the group told a news conference the death sentences were carried out at midnight. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. The man who created and did the voices for Miss Piggy, Cookie Monster, Bert, Grover, and Fozzie Bear is also a movie director. Frank Oz directed Steve Martin and Michael Caine in the comedy Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which has just come out on video. Frank Oz joined Jim Henson and the Muppets in 1963. He directed the Muppets on the big screen in The Muppets Take Manhattan. He directed a blood-sucking plant and a cast of humans in the movie musical comedy Little Shop of Horrors. And he was directed by George Lucas in The Empire Strikes Back, where Oz handled the puppet and the voice for Yoda the Jedi Sage. Oz's latest movie, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, is about two con men who fleece wealthy women. Michael Caine is rich, elegant, and debonair. Steve Martin is the loudmouth, crass American who runs more of a nickel-and-dime scam. When Steve Martin sets up shop in Michael Caine's turf, Caine devises a bet that he hopes will help him get rid of his vulgar competitor.
All right, Freddy. Suppose we try this. We find a woman, set a price, and the first man to extract the correct amount from her wins. But if you lose, you not only leave town graciously, you promise never to come back to Beaumont-sur-Mer again.
Done. Who's the woman?
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is an updated version of Bedtime Story, which starred David Niven in the Michael Caine role and Marlon Brando in the Steve Martin role. Had you seen that before making your new movie?
Yes. Yeah, I saw it when I was about, I saw it when I was about 17 or 18. It does not loom large in my memory, and I don't recall very much of it.
Did you want to see it again before making the new movie?
Yeah, I did. I requested to see it because I just thought I might be able to learn from it. And I saw it, and I did not learn a thing from it.
Well, was it disappointing? Here you were about to remake a movie, and maybe you weren't that wild about the original. Were you thinking, why am I doing this?
No, I always saw the potential in the script. I thought the script was a little gem. It was a delightful little gem of a script. And I in seeing the original, I still felt that there was a lot of potential in the script. I just thought the execution was not the best. Here I am, you know, my egomaniacal self talking.
Well, you had originally cast Steve Martin in the David Niven role. Steve Martin in the role of the refined, elegant, upper-class con man.
Right.
He ended up in the role of the loudmouth American.
Right.
Why did you initially have him in the more continental, refined role?
Well, I saw Steve in that. You know, I think Steve can do anything. And so when I first read the script, knowing a little bit of Steve, and not very much, knowing him personally from Little Shop and working with him in other times, and then socially seeing his house and just essentially knowing him to that degree, I saw that he was indeed erudite, bright, sophisticated, very smart, and very had taste. So I imagine that I was influenced by his personal life. It was Steve, after a few weeks, saying to me, you know, I was thinking maybe if I did Freddy, I could have a lot more opportunity for comedy. And I said, gee, I don't know. And then eventually he won me over, and we changed it. When Michael was available.
What made you decide on Michael Caine for the other role?
Well, you know, there's not many British actors who have the stature and the talent of a Michael Caine and who fit this particular role in age, in appearance. Michael was not available in the beginning. He was doing Jack the Ripper of the series, and only towards the end of our casting did he suddenly become available, because Jack the Ripper seemed to end a bit earlier than we thought. So just because he's such a talent, and he's just appropriate and just right for the role in this movie.
There's a very funny scene where Michael Caine takes on Steve Martin as his pupil and is tutoring him in the ways of the wealthy.
I'm glad you like that.
Oh, very funny. Tutoring him on how to hold a cocktail glass and how to very elegantly slip your hand into your dinner jacket while having the appropriate amount of self-satisfied contentment on your face.
Right.
How did you shape that scene?
Well, actually, I guess I should, just to point out to whoever's listening, it's really not a scene. It's a montage.
Mm-hmm.
It's short cuts put to music of Putting on the Ritz, as a matter of fact, kind of a big band version of Putting on the Ritz, which I love Miles Goodman to the music. It was in an earlier draft that was cut out, and I put it back in because I thought teaching Freddie would be very funny if it was done. It sounds odd, but if the actors weren't trying to be funny. In other words, they're not doing shtick.
Mm-hmm.
Steve is not all of a sudden being a clown. I think the humor lies in the fact that you know that Michael Caine is conning Steve as Freddy, and the Steve as Freddy is being extraordinarily earnest and sincere in trying to learn. You know? And I think that's where the humor lies, not in any comedy shtick they're doing, because it's quite subtle, I think.
Oh, there's another very funny scene where Steve Martin is in jail, and the only person he knows in the town that he's been imprisoned in is Michael Caine.
Right.
But he can't remember his name, and he's trying to convince the chief of police that it's on the tip of his tongue, but he's really bluffing his way through this.
Right.
And we have a clip of that scene. I want to play that.
I'll tell you about that, too.
Good.
All right, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of here?
Well, it's very difficult. The charges are serious, one. And you are a vagrant, an unknown.
I'm not a vagrant! This is my point!
Somebody here. I met him on a train. His name is... His name is James... No, his name is... James Josephson.
Lord, no. James Lawrence. Lawrence
Fells.
Lawrence Fangs.
Forrest... Lawrenceton.
His name is James Jessenvin.
Lawrence Jemison?
Yes! We're like this!
Let me tell you about that.
Oh, great, okay.
Because in the script, what it was Steve was supposed to say that the scene goes on, and then towards the end of the scene, very, very short scene, Steve says, I know a guy here. I know someone here. I met him on a train. His name is Lawrence Jameson. Cut to Lawrence Jameson. That's what the scene was supposed to have been. And then Steve started just playing around a little bit and trying to remember his name. I said, that's great. I just kind of egged him on, supported what he was doing. I said, go ahead and try it. And so we just tried it. We did five takes of him, each one different, totally ad-lib, of him trying to remember the name. And I bought the fourth one. And the reason I didn't buy the fourth one right away, as opposed to buying the fourth one and not doing the fifth, I did the fifth because I was down, kneeling on the floor, cueing Anton Rogers, the other actor in the scene, when he should interrupt Steve. And I was laughing so hard, I couldn't see what Steve was doing. So therefore, I had to go to the fifth one, and then I looked at the videotape, and I realized the fourth one was the best. So again, there's a situation where it's Steve. Let me expound a little bit more, I'm sick of being boring, but that's kind of in a microcosm why I wanted to do this movie, because you get somebody like a Steve Martin and a Michael Caine and a Glenn Headley and the other people, mainly Michael and Steve and Glenn. You want to really squeeze the juice out of their acting, and I felt a movie like this, where the lines weren't that important, really. It was the acting and performing was important. I think I felt that Steve and Michael, in particular, could really squeeze the juice between the lines out of the characters. And this is one example where the lines weren't important. It was the juice between the lines that was important.
You know, that scene really goes on where he's trying to remember the name.
Yeah.
And when I was seeing it in the theater, I was thinking, oh, about midway through the scene, I was thinking, oh, this is going on too long. And then a split second later, it got much funnier than it even had been.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing with timing, and I think you knew to let the timing go on with that.
Yeah, well, we did a cover on it. We did, which means we shot the other actor also. We took a picture of the other actor listening. And we could have shortened it, and we also could have lengthened it. But I felt, gee, it works. Let's just hang on, Steve. So we didn't do any cutting at all. And I think you're right. It does get funny, then it goes down a little bit, and you think it's over, and oh, you still can't remember, and he starts getting funny again. You just take a chance and let it happen.
To my knowledge, this is your first film that doesn't have puppets or a puppet-like plant in it. What's your relationship to puppetry and the Muppets now?
Well, I'll always be with the Muppets. I just will work about 10% of the year and not 100%. And I'll do Sesame Street for like 2 days a year because I love the characters and I love the people. But essentially, I'll try and squeeze some of that stuff in between movies now.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work with puppets, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is film director and puppeteer Frank Oz. He directed the new film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which stars Steve Martin and Michael Caine. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
In addition to directing Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, my guest Frank Oz was also an original member of Jim Henson's Muppet team. He created the characters of Miss Piggy, Bert Grover, Fozzie Bear, and the Cookie Monster. He also directed the films The Dark Crystal, The Muppets Take Manhattan, and the remake of The Little Shop of Horrors. You did puppets as a kid, and I wonder what kind of puppet shows you did.
Oh, I did variety shows, marionette variety shows, three-minute little acts strung together for about 20 minutes for supermarket openings and birthday parties and parking lots and fairs and church gatherings and anything like that. I made about $30 for half an hour show.
How did you end up staying with puppets as an adult? I think most adults would think of puppets as something that a kid will outgrow when they get older.
Just a very weird, sick person. I think is pretty much the answer. Well, actually, I wanted to be a journalist. I did puppets really as a means of, I think, expressing myself because they were ready at hand, because it pleased my parents. I was able to make some money as a youngster. I say between 11 and 17. Of course, when I'm 17, you never consider yourself a youngster. And then I decided, I never wanted to be a puppeteer. Never had a desire to be a puppeteer professionally. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to write a column in a paper. And then when I was about 19, I came to New York. Jim had asked me to work for him part-time, and I hadn't
Jim Henson really of the Muppets.
Right, I haven't stopped since.
Uh-huh. What do you think is different about the Muppets than puppets which preceded it?
Yeah, well, I think it's the tight shot of cameras. I think the tight shot of television created a particular style that Jim did. And that is that when you're working with normal puppets, and again, I'm not crazy about puppets. I care much more about character, and that's why I love Muppets, because they do character. But I think that the tight shot, the close-up in a TV situation, forces a puppet not to be just a wooden doll. It forced Jim, I think, and his creativity to have a mouth that opens and speaks in sync and have a cloth instead of wood, and the cloth is malleable and you can be much more subtle with your hand. I think that close-up really made the difference to Jim, and it both forced him and allowed him to break some bonds of puppetry. He did that. I had nothing to do with that. I wasn't even there.
I think the superstar of all the puppets, of all the Muppets that you created, was Miss Piggy. And if you could tell us what inspired her.
I'll be damned if I know. I don't know. I think, actually, it's always with in conjunction with the writers and Jim, the director. She was a pig, as there must have been half a dozen pigs in the first year of the Muppet Show, which kind of loosely used in the show. And at one point, It was Richard Hunt, who's another performer, and myself. We kind of used her at different times. And one show, I did her, and she came out of the chorus and attacked the frog romantically. And from that moment on, people started to laugh at her, and I started to have ideas with her and the writers. And then I took over. I said to Richie, it seems like I'm getting somewhere with her. And he said, fine. But I don't know what happened. All I know is that whatever neuroses I have has been filtered through her in some entertaining way, or used to have, maybe. And so she is now a... what I like about her, she's a very layered character. There's a lot of neuroses built inside her. And I've always felt that what's humorous about her is that she hides her pain.
Well, I want to play a short clip of your voice as Miss Piggy from the movie that you directed, The Muppets Take Manhattan. And in this scene, Miss Piggy is working at the perfume counter of a department store.
Oh, yeah.
And working with her is Joan Rivers, and they're selling a perfume called Quelle Différence.
I'll tell you about that, too.
Let's hear the scene first.
Get your Quelle Différence! It's French! It's feminine! It'll help you grab one of those rotten, stinking men! Quelle Différence!
Peter, please! You know, you were fine this morning. Something happened at lunch.
My frog turned on me.
Yeah, I had some bad tuna myself.
I'm gonna fight for him, though. I mean, do you think I'm pretty?
Of course you are. You're more than pretty.
Gorgeous.
Don't push it, Pig.
You were saying there was a story behind that?
I was directing that movie also, and we rented Bergdorf Goodman's on a Sunday, in the morning, and a Sunday all day. And Joan had to leave. She had an engagement that evening, some performance she had to do. So we only had her for one day, and not a complete day either. So I had two cameras going. And in the scene, really, although you didn't play at all, it ends with them hysterically giggling and losing control, just laughing like two friends laugh. It just wasn't working. I mean, it's very hard to, if you try, it's very hard to have a spontaneous laughter. It wasn't working, and because I didn't know Joan that well, I guess she didn't know me. So I said to one of the production assistants who were close to the Plaza Hotel, I said, get about four Bloody Marys. And so they came back after looking, and I had a couple Bloody Marys, and Joan had a couple Bloody Marys. And we shot the scene kind of like that. And actually, then Joan left. I had to do some pickup work. And I was feeling real good, and I didn't care where the hell the cameras were.
I'm trying to listen to your voice and hear how it's become the characters of Miss Piggy and Bert and Grover and
Don't
Fozzie
even
Bear.
Try. I'm amazed that I do Miss Piggy, first of all. The others I can understand a bit more. Piggy is beyond me. I have no idea how I do that. I mean, it's just, fortunately, I don't have to think about it. Neither do I have to think about the other characters. They're just there. They just happen. They're there after all this. All these years.
When you're manipulating the character of Miss Piggy,
mm-hmm.
where are
Which
you?
Which I don't do much anymore, actually.
You have other people do that?
No, nobody does my characters, nobody does Jim's characters, nobody does the other performers' characters. I just don't use her that much anymore. I try and save her for special occasions.
I can't believe she's allowing you to retire her.
I'm not retiring her.
She's so aggressive.
No, I'm not retiring at all. I'm just saving. I'm saving her for special situations, special TV shows, special moments, because she's very... special character, and also because I don't have time. I have a family, and I'm working on movies and all that stuff.
Now you did the role of Yoda for was it The Empire Strikes Back? I forget which in the series it was.
Empire Strikes Back and Revenge of the Jedi.
Did you do the voice and manipulate the puppet?
Yep, not at the same time. I looped the voice afterwards, months later, which means I put the voice in after we shot it, months later in the recording studio.
Magicians are very secretive about how they do their magic acts. Are puppeteers that way, too? Are the secrets of how Yoda works ever revealed to laymen?
Yeah. Yeah, find a layman, I'll tell him. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Not that I'd understand it anyways, probably, but I mean, are you guys secretive about that kind of stuff?
No,
mm-hmm.
Not me. I think when The Empire Strikes Back came out and Yoda was brand new, we were trying to be secretive then. Because George and me and everybody, we didn't want to talk about how it's done, because then people will talk about how it's done. What you want is to talk about the character.
Is it ever frustrating when you're working with real actors after you've worked with puppets for so long? You know, with a puppet, if you don't like the movement, you change it. You move your arm. You move the rod or whatever. You're working with an actor. They're a real person, and you can't just, you know, do the equivalent of pulling their strings.
You mean as a director or a performer?
As a director.
Well, it's bizarre. It's a question that's asked often in some form, and when I direct, which is a misnomer in the first place, but when I, because you don't direct people, you work with them, but when I work with the performers, the puppeteers, I don't work with the puppets. I don't talk to the puppets. I talk to the professional, hardworking people who, you know, work for 20 years, and essentially the difference between them and the normal actors, and they are actors, is that they will use puppets as a tool, and the actors will use their own bodies as a tool. Essentially, there's not much difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so I consider myself talking to actors either way.
When you were young...
I mean, I have to have an awareness of what the puppets do and what humans
right,
do.
Right, and I appreciate what you're saying. When you were young, and a lot of people expected you to outgrow puppets, you kept with them. Are you expected now to, in a way, outgrow puppets for dramatic films or comedic films with actors instead of puppets? Are you back into that stage of like, oh, well, you can get out of it now. You can leave the puppets behind now.
I don't know what's expected of me. I'm not sure. I think some people expect me to do only family-oriented movies. Some people expect me to stay with puppets. Some people expect me now to leave puppets and only do comedy. But mostly, I think people don't give a damn. I mean, I'm not that well known, and that people should waste a few seconds of their lives thinking about what Frank Oz is going to do. I'll just go ahead and do it. Hopefully, is best for my growth and what feels right. You know,
your last name Oz is a shortened version of
it's
your
a
family
sham.
Name.
It's a sham. It's a lie. I use Oz, my real and legal name, and I'm proud of it. And I'll never change it. Is Osnowitz. I just use Oz because. At one time, I was doing a TV show, and the person who was asking me to take a bow could not pronounce Osnowitz, and it was a weekly show, and I got bored, and so it was a suggestion of a friend, made it Oz. And so I use Oz, but it's not real.
But you knew what you were doing when you chose that as your name, huh?
Only not knew it. I've always been in school. My brother and I have been called Oz or Ozzy, so it's nothing really new. It's just an extension of that. I don't particularly like the connotation of the Wizard of Oz and people.
What? Why not?
Well, because there's a wonderment about it. There's a fainess about it, and it's boring to me. Essentially, there's no planned association. It just because that's what people called me when I was a kid anyway.
Okay, well, listen, thanks so much.
I mean, I love The Wizard of Oz.
Okay. Just in case we were wondering about it.
Yeah, it's just the use of it in my life, is that's all. Anyway, thank you very much.
Frank Oz's latest film, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, is now out on home video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the man who co-created Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman, TV producer Stephen Bochco. He has a new show that will premiere this fall called Doogie Howser, M.D. Well, let's bring back Frank Oz to sing a number as Miss Piggy.
No matter what life may bring, no matter what I may do, be sure of one special thing, I'm gonna always be loving you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Mickey Hart, drummer with the Grateful Dead, while traveling with the Dead on worldwide tours through India, Africa, and Egypt. Hart took his Nagra tape recorder into remote regions to record the local music. He's produced those tapes into a new series of CDs. Coming up, Mickey Hart talks about world music and the Grateful Dead. It seemed like a good idea back in the late 50s, a female Elvis Presley. A rock historian, Ed Ward, explains why the idea never got off the ground. And Mark Halliday returns to read a new poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Today has been a day off from work for much of the nation's labor force, a day to enjoy the unofficial end of summer. But there were also parades and speeches, and a time for politicians to campaign. In Philadelphia, more than 1,000 people representing about 100 area labor unions turned out for what was called one of the largest Labor Day rallies in the city's history. Doug Schlatter of members station WHYY has more.
Philadelphia area labor leaders say with declining union membership nationwide and with recent highly publicized strikes like Eastern Airlines, labor needs a shot in the arm. The rally's slogan was Unions and Unity. One of the marchers was Tom Cronin, who represents 4,000 white-collar city workers in Philadelphia. According to Cronin, Labor Day is not just a holiday for barbecues, but also for recognizing the accomplishments of the U.S. labor movement over the last century.
And they've been significant, whether it's been the 8-hour day or the abolition of child labor laws or pensions, vacations, health care, etc. There's certainly many significant contributions that labor has made, and we want to advertise those.
The march started at City Hall and ended up at Independence Hall. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Schlatter in Philadelphia.
Calm has returned to Virginia Beach after two nights of looting and violence. Now city officials are trying to determine what caused these disturbances involving thousands of young people. Ed Tillett reports from member station WHRO.
Order was restored early this morning when mounted patrols and club-wielding police marched for over 20 blocks, ordering everyone into their hotel rooms. The estimated 100,000 young people were in Virginia Beach for Greek Fest 89. Late this afternoon, Mayor Myra Oberndorf held a news conference where she discussed the holiday weekend incident, which ended in more than 500 arrests, dozens of injuries, and more than 100 businesses damaged. The mayor defended the actions of law enforcement agencies, saying authorities used a controlled response to the violence. But civil rights groups say they will continue to investigate charges of police brutality. Meanwhile, some area merchants are concerned that the weekend incident has left a scar on the resort's reputation. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Tillett in Norfolk.
All 54 people on board a missing Brazilian airliner are reported safe after the plane was found on a ranch in the Amazon rainforest. The plane disappeared from radar yesterday. While on a domestic flight, it had to make an emergency landing after losing its directional system. In Medellin, Colombia, a gunman opened fire at the airport terminal, killing one man and wounding 12 others. Police say the gunman was shot to death by police. It's unclear what prompted this attack, but the city has been the site of a number of bombings since drug cartels declared war on the government because of a crackdown on drug czars. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Back in the 1950s, honky-tonkin' was a mostly male sport, and making the music that accompanied it was also the domain of boys and men. But when Elvis came along, there was no holding back the girls. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of the women who tried to reign as queen in the shadow of the king.
Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Wild, wild boyfriends like to lose their minds. Wild men dig me.
There are some questions that seem to make sense until you ask them. Thinking about the 50s a few weeks ago, somebody asked me, in all innocence, why wasn't there a female Elvis? It would seem to make sense, after all, that if Elvis gave the girls something to scream at, and if screen idols like Marilyn Monroe and Natalie Wood were stirring up the boys' hormones, that a girl rockabilly would be a money-making machine. And it turns out that the answer to the question of a female Elvis is that there was a female Elvis. There were a dozen of them. But you've never heard of them unless you're a real rockabilly fanatic or a country fan. That's where a lot of these young women came from and where the ones who succeeded wound up. My favorite was Wanda Jackson from Maud, Oklahoma, who was Capitol Records' entry into the female Elvis sweepstakes and who, as you can hear, was perfectly capable of rocking out. She recorded lots of straight country just in case the rock and roll fad didn't work out, and that's the path she took until a religious conversion more or less ended her recording career. If you can find any of her old records, though, listen to them. Unfortunately, they're very hard to find, and the rockabilly stuff is only in print in France. RCA Records had the original Elvis, so they figured they had the inside track. When pretty teenage Janis Martin showed up in Nashville in 1956, they thought they'd found what they wanted.
They can call you Bill, or even Billy, but you're my sweet William and you drive me silly. Oh, Will, Will, you thrill me to my fingertips. William, 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 yum, 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 I love your tasty lips. William, William.
Janis's first record, Will You William, was a stone flop. And for her next record, they gave her something tested and true.
Hey there, baby, jump over here. When you do the ooby-dooby, I just gotta be near. Ooby-dooby, 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 ooby-dooby.
Of course, this was before the record industry learned that rock and roll fans don't buy multiple versions of a song, and Roy Orbison had already milked ooby-dooby dry. So the last we hear of Janis is this.
Just hit town, takes off like a rocket, and there he goes, rocking from his head down to his toes. My boy Elvis, real rock, my boy Elvis, real rock, with bambling, ooh, Elvis, sing for me. Heartbreak Hotel, in blue suede shoes, he walks away with all my blues. Take my troubles, take my pain, load them on that.
It was her biggest record, but that wasn't saying much. By 1958, Janis Martin's career at RCA was over. Now, if you know much about the history of rock and roll at this time, you're probably saying, sure, you'd expect big labels like Capitol and RCA to blow it. The small independent labels were where the action was. True. And on Cincinnati's Fraternity label, where Lonnie Mack recorded, we find a female rockabilly whose records are pure gold in collector circles today, Sparkle Moore.
You should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Oh, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah, you should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Oh, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah. Well, your man is to wear my batter off in a prison, cause you look like a child of driving everyone wild.
But, as you can hear, Skull and Crossbones had what might be called an eccentric vocal. She smoothed it out some for another record, Rock-a-Bop, but it didn't help much.
You take a rock and a bop when it's really neat, and you put them together with the rock-a-bop beat. Hey, Joe, hey, Joe, you're gonna do the rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, you're gonna swing your way in another rhythm. Ever stop, stop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop with me. Come on and rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, come on and rock-a-bop with me. You're gonna swing your way in another rhythm.
Fact was, people weren't buying male rockabillies who sounded like this, although today they're considered the top of the heap. No, the problem with all the female Elvises, including such unlikely personages as Alva Leslie, who combed her short hair back in a fair imitation of the original, but only succeeded in looking like a male impersonator, was that they were girls. And in the 50s, girls were supposed to act in a certain way. It was liberating to see the raw sexuality and frenzied excitement of an Elvis Presley show, but nobody wanted their girlfriend acting that way. And anything less wasn't really rock and roll. It was pop, which is how safer acts like Brenda Lee made it to the charts. In short, nice girls didn't act like that, and bad girls started out with three strikes against them. It would take 20 years for female rock and rollers to get to be an accepted part of the landscape, and by then, Janis Martin, Sparkle Moore, and Wanda Jackson's rocking days had been forgotten.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. The Grateful Dead aren't just a band, they're a phenomenon. They were probably the most celebrated psychedelic band of the 60s. They've been together for more than 22 years, and throughout that time they've had a following of fans, deadheads, so loyal they've made it their life's work to follow the Dead on the road. Mickey Hart is one of the Dead's two drummers. He joined the band in 1967. But playing with the Dead is just one aspect of his musical life. While traveling with the Dead around the world, Hart has taped singers and musicians from Africa, India, and the Middle East. Now that there's a growing interest in world music, Hart has produced his recordings from the 70s and 80s into a series of CDs on the Ryko disc label. The series includes Hart's 1978 recording of Nubian singer, songwriter, and oud player Humza Eldin. Has it been touring around the world with the Grateful Dead that's introduced you to a lot of the musicians who you've recorded?
No, not really. Mostly it was the Folkways collection that when I was a kid, I listened to a lot of these world music collections, and it brought the world into my living room, and it brought it alive. And that's where, and also the music on the streets, the Latin music, was what first gave me a hit of Western, of non-Western music, of third world music.
So while you were touring with the Dead, you were able to go to the musicians of different countries see them perform.
That's right.
Would you have to get to know somebody pretty well before being able to record them?
Oh, yes. You have to hang out, and you have to take part in the local customs. And so you have to have a stomach for this. This is something that is not what you want to do every day unless you really wanted to do it. It takes patience. There's it's very time-consuming.
How are the recordings that you made in the 70s and 80s released now on Ryko disc? What's the story behind that?
Well, it began in the early 70s with my interest in Naga recording and also seeing all the world music passing in front of me not being recorded. So I just ran tape. It was actually very selfish in those days. I just wanted a great recording of the world's music to listen to at night. You know, just curl up with a cup of cognac or something and sit up there, and it was sort of my wine cellar, my chateau, you know. And then, of course, a lot of these musics became so rare that they disappeared or on the endangered music list. And with the ecology being as frail as it is, these musics are attached to it, you know, to the rainforest. When a rainforest goes, the music of the rainforest goes. So now it's becoming more valuable because it's rarer. And it's become, people want to hear it now, and that's why I released it.
How has your exposure to world music changed your playing as a drummer and percussionist?
Oh, geez. It's hard to describe. I mean, in every which way you can imagine. You know, my sensibilities are completely different now than when I came out of school. I mean, I've learned to listen and play from a spiritual side and not necessarily a technical side. So, I mean, it's affected me deep, not only in my technique, but in the sensibility in which I approach the music.
One of the recordings on the Ryko Disc series is of your group, the Digga Rhythm Band, which, well, give us an idea of who's on it.
Oh, Digga was the maestro, Zakir Hussain, who's Alaraka's son, and about the finest percussionist on the planet now. And we put this together in the mid-70s, and it's a sort of a 20th century gamelan made of tuned percussion from all over the world. And this was this is the jewel of the collection, one of the jewels.
And what are you playing on this?
Oh, I play timpani, traps, drum set, dozens of instruments.
You've been playing with rock groups for over 20 years now.
Way over 20 years.
Way over 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
How does it affect your hearing, especially as the drummer? You're kind of in the middle of the loudest part.
You might say I'm in the middle of a lot of stuff. Well, there are certain frequencies in my hearing that aren't as sharp as others. After a tour, it takes me a while. I read lips for about a week or so, and then it goes away, and then I'm pretty normal. But there are a few places in my hearing that have cuts and drop out, and I'm aware of them, and I take them into consideration. Like little birdies up in the tree way far away are a little hard for me to hear sometimes. But then I can hear up to 18,000 cycles, 19,000 cycles.
Does this ever interfere with either your ability to hear more quiet musicians play or your ability to mix stuff?
Not the quiet. The quiet part, I can my ears tune in, and they focus on the quiet. See, in the Grateful Dead, it's huge volume. I'll admit there is lots of volume, but it's really clean. There's no square waves. There's no distortion. Everything is pure. So you can take a lot of volume, and if the sound is pure and not distorted, and, you know, with whining guitars, all of our guitars just are very crystal, and they all sing, and they're all in tune, and it's a very pristine sound, even though it comes to you at 140, 130 dB.
Your father managed the band for a short time.
That's right.
In 1970, I think he joined. How did that happen, that your father became the band's manager?
Well, we really weren't into the business. We never really looked at the business, and we were failing miserably. We were owing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And my father had business experience, even though he was a crook. Of course, I didn't know that then. And he was the only one around that knew how to sign a check or anything. Or really, you know, we just went into playing. We were just mad kids, you know, just trying to play music every minute of the day. And we just didn't want to be bothered by the world. So he managed us, and, of course, turned out that he was a crook and stole lots of money from the band. And, you know, it's just a big, horrible story.
Well, when he left the band, the Dead put out a warrant for his arrest for embezzling,
that's not true.
Didn't they?
No, the police did. It wasn't
Dead.
No, the Grateful Dead don't put people in jail. He just stole money. You know, I mean, it wasn't like he killed us or anything. So they prosecuted him. It wasn't the band.
Uh-huh. Were you embarrassed about that?
Embarrassed? That was a mild. That's one way to put it. I was disgraced. Actually, it was disgraceful. You know, that your father should steal from a son, especially from the Grateful Dead, which was like Santa Claus. Grateful Dead never hurt anybody. He was just a crook. He just happened to be my father.
So
you can't choose your father.
Well, how did that change your relationship with him?
Well, I never saw him again, you know, until he died.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then I buried him, and that was that.
Huh. You left the band shortly after he did, right?
That's right.
Was it because of
that was a big part
embezzling?
Of it. Yeah. It made me feel real bad, but my brothers never really blamed me for it, but I was sort of shamed, and I just sort of hunkered off to my barn, and I built my recording studio and did Rolling Thunder and learned how to engineer and put together my own personal music and found out what I sounded like beside the Grateful Dead. And then when I had enough of that, I walked back into the Grateful Dead and assumed the position.
So in a way, it worked out for you.
Oh, it worked out fine. Mm-hmm. Everything works out, always works out.
Why did you rejoin the Dead?
Because they're my band, you know, I mean, because I couldn't stand being without it, and they needed me, and I needed them. That's why I joined back. Well, you didn't really join. It's not like you sign in or out of the Grateful Dead. You either are or you're not. It's not one of those things that, you know, you sign up or you sign out.
The Dead is one of the few rock bands with two drummers in it. How do you coordinate that?
Well, you coordinate it from the heart, you know. Billy and I are tied by the heart, you know, and we really love each other as human beings, and also our styles are completely different, so we don't compete with each other, and there's no competition, and it's sort of like a marriage. And the thing that we do collectively is more powerful than the thing we do individually.
Were you in a period with the Grateful Dead ever of doing like a whole lot of drugs while performing?
Oh, of course. Taking a lot of acid? Of course, yeah. The Grateful Dead collectively did psychedelics in the early days, and that was one of the things that based its music on, the collective experience of psychedelics.
When did you stop using psychedelics?
In the 70s.
What was the reason for stopping?
Well, it's really hard to take care of the kids high on acid and stuff, you know? You know what I mean? It's just not done. It's irresponsible. And with the family and with other responsibilities. And once you've been there, you've been there. And it just was going back to the same old place. And when we took psychedelics, it was more of a sacrament. You know, it was trying to find a higher order. It wasn't going ya-ya in the trees, you know, in the woods, just going out there and partying at the beach with beer. I mean, the only time we did it was when we played. And it was sort of like church to us. It was like that kind of experience.
Do you expect the Dead to stay together for years to come?
Oh, I think so. I think as long as that we're up and we love to play, it'll stay together as long as we're healthy. I would like to turn the clock myself. I would like to take this into the 2000s. That's sort of what I had in mind. But you never can tell. I mean, the Grateful Dead is a gigantically strong thing, but it's also like walking on eggshells. You know, it's very delicate. So we'll see.
Grateful Dead drummer Mickey Hart. Here's more of the Digga Rhythm Band with Hart and Zakir Hussain, produced by Hart for the World Series of Recordings on the Ryko Disc label. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington. Coming up on All Things Considered, these are our lead stories today. Virginia Beach rioting overnight last night as the college students leave the city. We'll ask what happened. Colombia, there's been more violence during the day today and last night as American supplies begin to arrive. And in South Africa, demonstrations there are continuing, and we'll cover that story. We'll also take a look at an anniversary. Paul Robeson gave a concert 40 years ago in Peekskill, New York, and caused a riot. And we'll be talking about Afrocentric schools, schools that teach a black tradition to young American children. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every day brings confusing thoughts and mental deadlocks, but you find a way to get by. That's the subject of a new poem by Mark Halliday. We asked him to read it. It's called Pasco, Barbara.
I find I am descending in a propeller plane upon Pasco in the state of Washington. I accept this. I know what I'm doing. Down below, the land is printed with huge circles. It is the irrigation system. It makes sense, because there are people who understand it, living with dignity in square houses, and the result, possibly, is 1 billion radishes. Now some so-called time has passed. The taxi driver experiments with very narrow streets to shorten our detour, and he says the Eagles will out-tough the Steelers. Do I argue? I conserve my strength. After a while, I have this unsettlingly smooth tuna salad with a pale pickle in a drugstore designed by Dwight Eisenhower, reading a few poems by David Rivard. I have thoughts. I have my Uncle Ralph's jacket soft and droopy, giving me a sense of the past. But the rain is saying on the roofs of retail outlets, no guarantee. But that is so normal if you think about it. In a parking lot, I turn back toward the store to explain to the cashier that she charged me for 6 cans of seltzer, when in fact I only had 1 can from a 6-pack. But the idea of justice seems so fatiguing, I would rather just read a surprisingly serious detective novel. So I vibrate with indecision in the parking lot till all the car windows rattle imperceptibly. Then an alleged interval ostensibly intervenes. At the mall, a woman at a piano has played 1,800 songs from memory, according to the radio personality who stands with a mic explaining her bid for the Guinness Book of Records. I am walking elsewhere singing Tiny Montgomery, which I bet she wouldn't have been ready to play. I have this inner life. I think of my father, lonely in Vermont. I think of myself, lonely in Syracuse, of myself elsewhere, and of my old poem about a detective who can't solve a vast case, and as a result, I have feelings. But my teacher said, the future of American poetry can't be merely the notation of sensibility. When he said that, I felt a chilly fear at the edge of conch, conch, conch consciousness, like an ice cube in the corner of my stomach. That's how I felt. So then, consequently, I went shopping for some serious ideas, but then Ashbury phoned and left a message after the beep. Don't be a sucker. Ideas are for patsies. This made my throat get sort of dry, and then time passed, so to say. The texture, how it is and was, the how of how. I take my negatives to the camera store, but what comes back is never in living color. But I'll go along with this charade until I can think my way out. I've come this far. That day in 1971, I hitchhiked all the way to Montpelier, didn't I? And here I am. Suddenly, I have a son who focuses with tremendous insistence upon dogs, balloons, air conditioners, hats, clocks, and noses. To him I say, the world is okay. Life is good. We can accept it. Your dad is a little mixed up, but your shoes got tied, didn't they? As Barbara Cohen in high school said about politics, it's interesting, giving the word 4 earnest syllables. Interesting.
Mark Halliday teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Stephen Bochco is the co-creator of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, and Hooperman. On the next Fresh Air, Bochco tells us about his new series. Also, we meet Academy Award-winning sound designer Randy Tom. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.